Hi, I am Mark Easter at Marcus Stamp Company, and you are listening to Stamp Show here today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show here today, episode number 80.
I'm Cash.
I'm Tom.
I'm Scott.
And I'm your host, Dawn. This week, we'll be wrapping up New York 2016, a discussion on Stanley Gibbons, Cash's corrections, including which came first, the chicken or the egg, and our expert topic is what you can expect when selling your collection to a stamp dealer. So it's time for hashtag stamp stories, New York 2016. So Scott, you're back now. How was the show? We want to know all the awesome details.
Well, I had a great time at the show. It was huge. Bigger than they had exhibits on both sides of the exhibit hall, and the dealers were kind of scrunched in the middle. There were two large entrances in the Jacob Javits Center in New York City. So there were two large entrances. One entrance was where Linz and the APS had their booths, and the other entrance was more auctions and things like that. And the entrance where the APS booth was much more busy, much more active throughout the entire show than the other side of the room. So the dealers who actually chose booths on that side of the room seemed to have a lot more traffic and have better sales. That was just my opinion. But I heard from a lot of dealers that they all did well. So that was a good thing. The exhibits were amazing. The Court of Honor was incredible. I got to see the British Guiana. That was in a glass box that was about maybe a foot. It was a glass cube about a foot on each side. So you couldn't really get too close with that one. But you could see how poorly it's weathered the last 20 or 30 years. But there were some other really cool rarities in there. I got really close to the 1 cent Z grill. That was just in a standard exhibit frame, which means I could get within half an inch of the stamp when viewing it. And I was able to look at it really closely. So that was really cool. There were some other things. There was an invitation, a Mauritius cover with the post office stamps.
Post office instead of postpaid.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. There were nearly full sheets of Great Britain number one and number two. There were a lot of great things in the Court of Honor. If you missed it, you really missed some great, great exhibits. And hopefully they will put some of that online so that people who didn't get a chance to go to the show will be able to see it. Some of the booths that the postal administrations had were very attractive. In particular, Canada Post. We've talked about the Canadian stamps and how good their designs have been lately. Everything from Star Trek to Zambonis to all sorts of stuff. And yes, I did buy some Zamboni stamps. I finally
nice.
Got some. I bought all of the Star Trek stuff that they had. And then they had some other great stuff. You're the Chinese New Year stuff and dinosaurs and birds and all sorts of great stuff. Highly recommend their stamps as far as the aesthetic and the design qualities go. They're just putting out some really, really nice stamps at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to cost me a bunch of money on that one.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Tom. I gave Tom a little Canada Post brochure, and he took it home and gave it to his daughter. And apparently she is into everything, dinosaurs and animals and birds.
Oh, she is.
And
she wants to
fishes.
Be a paleontologist and... We had to go to Target that night, and she actually wanted to take it so she could continue reading it while sitting in the cart while we were shopping.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Well, the one thing that impressed me that you brought back was the New York 2016 folder with all the issues in it.
Well, yeah, let me talk about
oh,
that.
Oh, man.
The U.S. Postal Service actually had 7 first day ceremonies, one for each of the first 7 days. And obviously the last day they didn't have one, but for what they had for sale was a commemorative book that they sold. It was $40, I think. They gave you a tote bag and the book. And the book had one sheet of forever stamps in it, and that was the previously issued design for the New York 2016 show. Then it had a space and a little and a descriptive page for each issue that was issued at the show. And so I bought one of each and I put them in the book, and it looks really, really cool.
That Except being, for the confetti stamps.
Yeah, the confetti stamps. But the book looks really cool. So I have that as a commemorative of the show. Let's see, what else did I do? Oh, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So the story of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing book, they were offering that as a raffle prize, and they raffled off a number of them every day. And I was fortunate enough to win one of their raffles.
Oh.
I had a friend who won 4 books over the course of the entire show. Well, they started out the first day, they were holding the raffle every 2 hours, and they were giving away 2 books. And by the end, they were giving away 6 books every 2 hours. So he managed to get 4 books. And at any given raffle drawing, there were probably, I would say, maybe 20 to 40 people waiting, because you had to be present to win after the first day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he won, I think he won 1 or 2 on the first day. But you didn't have to be present.
Yeah.
So lucky him. And the nice thing was he was just giving the books away. He'd win it, and then he'd find somebody that wanted it, and he'd
give
it away.
We'll give him a plug then.
Oh,
he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Curtis.
Curtis, hey.
All right, Curtis.
Yay, Curtis.
Give a shout-out to two of our great fans out there. Number one fan, Marcel Sleeker.
Oh, yes.
It was great to meet you and hang out with you for a little bit.
Co-inventor of the tube sock, by the way.
Yes.
Yes. great talking to you, and we hope to hear from you again soon. And then also our friend Patrick Reedy from New York came by, and he found me on the floor and said hi, and we talked for a few minutes. And we even took a selfie.
All right.
In front of the exhibits.
A selfie.
So, yeah, my first selfie. Well, actually, it's my second. My first one was with my wife.
Uh-huh.
So, but I don't normally take selfies, but I thought that was really cool. And I had to let Kaz know that we were there, so. I could have done better, but
we'll post it somewhere. We'll make you famous.
Yeah.
So that was great. I saw that, well, they auctioned an inverted Jenny, brought it hammered at $1.175 million.
Yeah, insane. Just
But a lot of the auction realizations were insane. A lot of them were.
Yeah.
I sat in on the H.R. Harmer auction. And I saw one lot open at $1,600 and hammered for $85,000.
Yeah, showed me those the other day. One of them opened for $1,400 and hammered down for $70,000.
Yeah, some of the bidding was just insane.
Yeah.
I mean, and the interesting thing was he would open a lot and it would sit there and he'd get ready to close it, and then all of a sudden the bidding would start.
Yeah.
And it'd get to about a midpoint. And it would stall, and he'd get ready to close it, and it would take off again.
Well, there was a person who is a big Pony Express collector, and he has big, huge bags full of money to spend on stuff. And in the end, he bought one little ratty thing. He got totally shut out, and it wasn't like he was the second bidder. He was like the fourth bidder. He just looked at the stuff and went, oh man, I can't spend that.
yes,
just incredible prices.
The auctions were just nuts.
Anybody who says the stamp market is dropping, yeah, this is real
well,
good
definitely
proof
not from a
not.
Dollar value point of view.
Yeah.
That's for sure. The good stuff,
yeah,
and the stuff that's in high demand is certainly strong.
Yes, which reaffirms what Richard Lehman was saying, the top of the market is exploding.
Yes. Now, a couple other neat exhibits that they had. They actually had a Curtis biplane in the atrium of the Javits Center. And this was actually a Navy trainer plane that had been restored. And it actually flies every week out of an aerodrome there in New York or New Jersey.
Cool.
And but they parked it in the atrium for the entire week. And it's... It was painted navy gray with the navy insignia, but it's actually the same model as what the early mail planes were. So that was a really cool exhibit. And then they had one sent through $1 full sheets of the 1893 Columbians, 1892 Columbian.
What, he couldn't issue. Afford the $2, $3, and $5?
There are, those sheets no longer exist.
I would be shocked if they did.
But that's the last, the one they had on display was the last surviving sheet of 100.
Wow.
Of the $1. They also had largest surviving block of the $2 Trans-Mississippi, the block of 25. They also had a printing press from Ludwig and Hoyer. And if you don't know who they were the one of the companies that printed Confederate States stamps. And they had printing stones that I don't think they were the actual printing stones for this, but they did have stamp images on some of the stones. I would suspect that that's just an example of a printing stone for that particular type of printing press. But that was really cool, too. Now, they didn't operate it, which would have been even cooler.
Oh, yeah.
But they just had a standing display, and it was neat to see the printing press. So the Postal Service had a bunch of big, big exhibits. So, but the, like I said, the stamps that the Postal Service issued were hit and miss. They issued the national parks, which we all agreed we liked those designs.
Yes.
10 stars.
The the planets.
9 stars.
The Pluto Explored.
10
small
stars.
Small souvenir sheet. So
it's going to drop really quick.
It is. the classic stamps.
5.
Those definitely should have been lick and stick, not self-adhesive. Yeah, that's for sure.
Say the one that gets 0.
The Celebrate.
Colorful Celebration.
Colorful Celebration.
0 stars.
Yeah. 0 stars. You're right. That one kind of sucked. They did have a little photo booth where you get your picture taken against a green screen, and then it would print out a couple of postcards with your image on there. It said, "Greetings from New York 2016.
I got one of those with a guy named Scott Murphy on it. I wonder if it'll be worth something someday.
Maybe not.
Probably what you paid for it.
Yeah, probably what you paid for it. Well, that's about it, other than hitting the dealers for more stuff that I didn't need or couldn't afford. But other than that, I had a great time. It was good to see New York. I had a few adventures in New York outside of the show as well. And I look forward to seeing everybody and anybody who wants to come up and say hi at the
Portland,
next show.
Portland,
my next
Portland.
Show. My next show is, yes, the APS show in Portland in August.
We're all going there.
Yes. Yay.
Yay.
Back to Dawn.
And back to me. Stamp news. Stanley Gibbons. With a distinguished heritage dating back to 1856, Stanley Gibbons is the world's longest established rare stamp merchant. Stanley Gibbons is listed on the London Stock Exchange with ticker code SGI. It has a market capitalization of 24.38 million pounds. Stanley Gibbons has traded as high as 3.5 pounds, but now is at 14 pence. Stanley Gibbons shares currently trade at 38% discount to their last reported tangible net asset value of 23.9 pence per share. This asset value is based on the purchase cost of the firm's inventory of rare stamps, coins, and antiques. Stanley Gibbons has seen a sharp turndown in sales to Asian clients with the drop in the Chinese markets. This is what the London stockbrokers attribute the drop to. We are not stock analysts, but we do know the market. What do you think?
I think they were pushing stamp investments and somebody said, not so much.
Well, that's what I thought also. And if you go online, there are some fairly large strings that people are talking about this. This is not like, you know, somebody may be listening out there and go, who cares or whatever. But this is actually kind of big news on a lot of the websites. They blame it, though, on the fact that there aren't a lot of Chinese people buying investment stamps. That when the Chinese market dropped, they dropped. But they dropped to 14 pence per share.
3.5 pounds.
Or 3.5 pounds.
But I don't think that their investment portfolio was just Chinese stamps. So you can't really blame it on the Chinese investor.
Because it's not.
Chinese typically invest in Chinese stamps.
Yeah, I have.
So I don't think that a loss of Chinese investors is necessarily the actual cause. And because I can't see that they had a lot of Chinese investors in non-Chinese stamps.
Well, the other thing, too, that they point out is that if the company liquidated and you bought it at 14 pence per share, you would actually make money when they sold the stamps because their stamps are worth more than their stock is. So that's kind of a, you know, a lot of stamp collectors, not market people, but stamp collectors are going, well, you know, if I can buy 25 pence worth of stamps for 13 pence and do that, you know, obviously you're not going to do it once, you're going to buy like several thousand shares of stock. But it's this thing is getting hammered. And when you read on the blog sites, you know, they blame everything in the world on it. And I have no clue what it is. All of a sudden, though, nobody wants Stanley Gibbons stock.
I don't know. They had a table at the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and they just sold, you know, talking about whether they have Chinese stamps or not. They just sold a Great Britain number 33.
They sold two of them, actually.
Well, the one that was just recent. Yeah, they sold two of them. There's only five of them in existence. And they sold one a while ago, and they just sold another one, plate 77. Just for people who don't know, this is the 1 cent red Great Britain stamp with Queen Victoria on the head with the letters in all four corners. They printed a sheet. They said, this is a crummy, crummy plate. Let's not use this anymore. And they threw it away. And somebody said, well, what do I do with the sheet of stamps? And somebody said, well, just put it in the stack and sell it. So one sheet of it was printed and then shipped off to the post offices for sale. So there are five of these known, and it sold for $500,000 for that one stamp. So Stanley Gibbons has some significant inventory, and their stock is just getting hammered for all sorts of reasons, and who knows what the real reason is. But it's going to be interesting to follow for the next year.
And now for Cash's corrections.
Well, first of all, an update. This is from a while ago when the gyrocopter pilot landed on the White House lawn. He was discharged yesterday. He can face 9.5 years for landing there. And it's going to go to trial now. So that's what he's facing is 9.5 years.
Well, that's not too bad.
Yeah. Well, no, and I looked, nobody said anything about what happened to the letters. We don't know if they're still in evidence or whatever. I'm guessing they are.
I would suspect so.
Yeah, but I would sure like to get one of those letters. And the second thing, you know, we're all about the chickens here.
No, Cash, you're all about the chickens.
Okay. I'm all about the chickens. So there's a famous paradox that is, what came first, the chicken or the egg? So on YouTube, there's a great channel called ASAP Science. And they gave a great answer that goes into evolution and defining proto-chicken and shell hardening and stuff. But it basically boils down to one surprising thing. And I'll use the example that they used. Picture an elephant laying an egg. And then the egg hatches, and a lion comes out. Now, do you call that egg an elephant egg because an elephant laid it, or do you call it a lion egg because a lion came out of it? If you call it an elephant egg, then by definition, the chicken came first. If you call it a lion egg, then the egg came first. So it depends on your definition of egg as to whether the chicken or the egg came first. And
see,
I thought that was really cool.
To me, it's a point of view.
However you define it, it's interesting.
I think the platypus came first.
And also our YouTube channel just went up. We have several YouTubes up, including the one on expertizing blue paper. So, you know, we discussed it. It's hard to see an audio podcast. We put it on there. We put pictures. So if you want to get more into the blue paper, what we were discussing, you can pull it up on YouTube at Stamp Show Here Today. And it's got a great little picture of Frank Sinatra in front that Calvin put on it. I thought that was cool for old blue eyes and all that stuff. But if you are interested in the blue paper, go to the YouTube site and check out our channel. And if you like what you see, subscribe. Hopefully you'll be entertained by them.
And if you have any suggestions for videos that you would like to see, please email us.
Absolutely.
At bluepaper@gradingmatters.com.
Yep, bluepaper@gradingmatters.com. And that's it.
Oh, my God, who the hell cares?
And now our expert topic, selling stamps back to stamp dealers. So, Scott, what is your opinion on selling to dealers?
Well, I like selling to stamp dealers. Many of them are my friends. But that being said, we collect as a collector. Where do you get your stamps? You either get them from a dealer or at an auction. Now, whether that dealer is an eBay dealer or a brick and mortar dealer that has a store or a dealer that does shows, it's still a dealer. And those dealers, that's their job. That's how they make money. That's how they...
Or they fund their habit.
Yeah.
Like me.
That's how they, you know, generally, that's how they feed their family, send their kids to school, all that sort of stuff.
Or buy more stamps.
Or buy more stamps to sell to you. I get a lot of questions. Well, isn't the stamp dealer taking advantage of me? He's offering me so much less than my stamps are worth. And I thought that it would be good just to do a quick exercise in, well, really, what should the stamp dealer be paying you? Based on just common sense, if a stamp is listed, and we'll say that the stamp is in very fine condition, it's listed in the catalog at $100, and you go to buy that stamp from a stamp dealer. Typically, that stamp dealer, let's say he offers it to you at 80% of catalog value, so he wants $80 for it. He is asking $80, but he gives you a 20% discount. So now you've actually paid $65 for that $100 stamp. Now, what does the stamp dealer have to pay to acquire that $100 stamp that he just sold to you for $65? Well, depending on his business model, he should be either anywhere from doubling to tripling his money. That stamp dealer, in effect, should be paying no more than 20 to 30% of the catalog value, or $20 to $30. Depending on whether he's tripling or doubling his money. So when you take your $100 stamp to sell to a stamp dealer and he offers you $20, that's a perfectly fair offer for that stamp. Now, when you consider that you have an entire collection and a lot of your stamps may not be in very fine or better condition, you're going to have some fine to very fine or average stamps in your collection. And he's going to buy it all. A lot of those stamps he can't sell singly or quickly. And he's either going to have to sell them as a lot for much less, or he's going to have to hold on to them until the buyer comes along that wants that stamp for his collection. So now that percentage overall has to be lower. And when you take a large collection to a stamp dealer and he offers 12% or 15%, that is really actually a fair offer for your stamp collection.
I hate using the word fair. I just don't like the word. Well, I think that when you get into the economics of it, it's a equitable price. It's a price where both of you should be able to make money.
The stamp dealer is not taking advantage of you at that price point, so equitable would be a good word. But that's the reality. The stamp dealer also has to invest time. When he buys a large collection, he has to invest time in sorting through the collection, any better items that might need certification. He has to go through and he has to submit those and pay for certificates. And then he has to market those stamps. He has overhead for his business as well. So all of these things feed into why the stamp dealer can't pay you the catalog value of a stamp. And it all starts with the fact that, first of all, he's probably not selling it at full catalog value anyway.
Yeah.
So selling to dealers is great. You generally get your money right away. Whereas if you sell it at auction, you may have to wait 3 months or 6 months or more to get your money.
Typically more.
Sometimes an auction house will give you an advance against what they expect your collection will bring. But depending on the value, they may not offer that.
Yeah, I agree 100% with everything you said there. One of the biggies is if you just think about it. You're selling your stamps to a dealer. Well, where is the dealer? You walk into his shop. You walk up to his shop. You put your stamp collection on it. Right off the bat, you should know that he's in his shop. So he has to pay rent. The lights are on, so he has an electric bill. The air conditioner is on, you know, stuff like that. He's got to pay for all that stuff, and he has to pay for that stuff by marking up the stamp. I just had a person who walked in today who had an old citation album from his father. I looked through it, and, you know, it's probably worth $100. I told him it was worth somewhere between $50 and $100. And I told him to keep it because it's worth more sentimental value being from your father than it ever will be for selling his stamps. Guaranteed his father paid more for it because his father bought the stamps clearly out of packets. And so, you know, he may have spent $500 on packets, but he got probably $500 of enjoyment out of it too. So when people race model boats, they don't sit there and at the end and say, well, how much money am I going to make by racing model boats? You know, it's sort of the same thing with stamp collecting. And sometimes you pay for the enjoyment and sometimes you get profits, but the profits come from you basically doubling or tripling the value of your collection. If your stamp collection doubles in value, you're going to get it all back because after it doubles in value, then you'll break even when you sell it to the dealer.
Well, I think you're getting into a difference between collecting and investing in stamps.
Right, and this is definitely much something in the area of a collector, not an investor.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And as an investor, you should have certificates on your more expensive stamps. And really, as an investor, you probably should have certificates on everything you buy.
Well, also as an investor, you're not dealing with a stamp collection. You will be dealing with individual stamps. If you are a true investor,
that's correct.
You will buy a certain stamp and you will pay $150 for it and it'll have a certain, then you'll go off there and try to sell it for $175 or $200. You will not necessarily be selling it to a dealer though.
Right.
You're going to try to find the
one of the things you're probably going to do that's going to end up in an auction, not at a dealer.
At an auction or on eBay yourself, your choice.
Now realize when you sell on eBay though, you're the dealer, which means you're not going to get that $100 for your $100 stamp either because eBay is that kind of marketplace. It's a discount marketplace.
Right.
And you're probably going to be lucky if you get $50 for it.
Yeah, a dealer will get $65.
But now you've also had to do all of the dealer work, mm-hmm. plus pay the eBay fees and the PayPal fees. So you've got the overhead also. So you're really not getting $50. You're probably getting $37 or something like that.
Well, and then you make $40. And then you're going to have to go in and do it a stamp at a time versus just selling your collection.
Right. You know, I look at it from a standpoint of if you are a stamp collector and you want to sell your collection, pull all the big stuff out of it. Anything that you think is going to sell for more than $300. And I always say this, it's not like I'm pushing us, but if you expect more than $300, get it certed, put it into an auction or sell it to a dealer, negotiate it on a stamp-by-stamp basis.
But
then take your book and say, boom, how much will you give me for the rest of this?
Well, that's exactly one of the things that I did one time when I was dealing and my wife were dealing in Disney pins. We had a friend who had bought bulk amounts of pins, some of them very good, and he wanted to get out of it. So we made a deal with him to pay him for everything that he had. And my wife took the time and she individually started putting these pins up on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about 4 or 5 months of selling stuff on eBay, we realized we got rid of all the good stuff. We made our money and then some. You know, we got all of our money back that we invested in it. This is probably going to take us forever to sell the rest of it because they're not limited editions. They're not special. And then we then took everything that was left and went to a local shop that sells pins and said, here's what we got. What do you give us for it? You know, and then, so that's how we got rid of the bulk.
Yeah.
Not useless, but the common stuff.
And another way to have done that would have been to lot it, just like an auction house would on eBay, and say, well, here's 25 pins for a price. And you sell it as groups of pins instead.
We did that for a while.
Yeah.
That's how we got rid of the rest, a bunch of the stuff. But then it got to a point where we're just starting to relist them. Now it's just time to cut and run.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Cash does the same thing. He sells stuff on eBay, the stuff that doesn't sell. He drops the price, starts them at a penny, and anything else that doesn't sell goes in a box.
Yep.
And once or twice a year, he takes it over to the auction house and says, here, sell this. And so they all go as a big box lot, and somebody will pay, you know, $100, $250, so whatever, for Cash's box lot of stuff that he couldn't sell.
Yeah, I am definitely a stamp collector, and I am definitely a stamp dealer. I am both.
Right.
I sell on eBay, and, you know, like Tom said, I will list things at a penny, and they won't sell. And I'll sit there and go, holy crap. I listed this for a penny. I paid 10 cents to list it. Yeah, this is out of here. So, and I just dropped four boxes of stuff off at Tom Mills at HR Harmer. Shout out to Tom. And four boxes, I figure I'll get $125 to $200 per box because these are full boxes. And they're just stuff that I don't want to work on. And you know, somebody at a shop will throw them inside of their bin and say, here, pick stamps at 10 cents each.
Or covers at 50 cents each, yeah, or something like that. And they'll sell a bunch, and then they'll have a bunch left over, and then it all just gets recycled, yeah, again and again and again.
But otherwise, you know, I would have four boxes, and I wouldn't have just four boxes. I've been doing this for many years. I probably have 50 boxes of
crap. That's clearly the stuff,
yeah,
that does not sell as individual stamps. And, you know, we started this discussion with a single stamp at $100. Well, when you have a collection, you have a lot of items,
yeah,
that really aren't single item sales. By themselves, they're not worth enough money to trade as a single stamp.
Oh, a dealer isn't, you know, if you bring up a stamp, realistically, the catalog's $100. The dealer isn't going to, like, negotiate a price on that stamp. He's going to look at groups of stuff. And you may...
Well, you're assuming you have a collection then.
Yeah. This ties in last week to the talking about press sheets. But I have bought and sold, I think I'm on my fourth White Ace mint collection in the little black books with the plastic slip covers. They look really nice and everything. I'm buying them for like half face, 60% of face. And the dealer I'm buying them from is making money. So, you know, they're paying less. They're not even, you know, the people aren't even getting face. That's why I thought that the Imperf press sheets would be good, because I kind of believe that those are always going to go for at least face and maybe more.
Well, but they've pulled the press sheets now off of the website. You can't buy them anymore. They pulled all of the Imperf press sheets off of the website.
How do you find them now?
They're reevaluating whether that's going to be part of the program going forward.
Oh, bummer, because I wanted to get the classic... U.S. stamps, because I wanted to cut out the imperforated stamps and make them imperforated.
Well, just think, now all your press sheet stock just went up in value.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, it either went up in value or down in value.
Well, we're talking to selling dealers. I'm gonna jump on the edge of the cliff here.
Uh-oh. I'll hold you back.
If you are selling your stamp collection to somebody, or one that you inherited, and there is, say, a $10,000 stamp in it, but you know nothing about stamps, and the dealer offers you a low price, be it that he knows that's in there or not, and you find out later that you had, holy cow, one of those stamps was $10,000. Did the dealer cheat you, or is it your responsibility to look up what you're selling?
That's a good question.
That's why I'm going to jump on the edge of the cliff, because there's people who can get really upset about this kind of stuff.
Let me start by saying that in California, there is a law that when a stamp dealer who is considered a professional deals with a collector who is considered an amateur, and there are certain requirements when the professional deals with an amateur. Now, if it's one professional to another, fair game.
Yeah.
But as a professional, when you're dealing with an amateur, I believe you are bound by law to
treat them fairly.
Now, is that a state law?
Yes.
You know, it's a state law, but almost every single state has it.
Or
something similar. I know it's in Utah because I was contacted by the DA to be a professional witness for one where they were going after...
Because I bring it up because it's something when I was into pin trading and stuff, something that I saw a terribly large amount of the time is somebody had a pin in a book that they had no idea that it was worth, you know, $100. Pins aren't nearly as expensive as some of the stamps are. And someone traded them. They liked some small little pin. And they said... sure, I'll make that trade with you. And you can tell the person that made the trade knew full good and well that they were giving you a $5 item for a $100 item.
I know stamp dealers who, I'll name one. Ray Martin with Quality Philatelic. Shout out to Ray. He will give you a fair price. We talk all the time. he is ashamed sometime of some of the other dealers. And he gives people good prices, and and that's one of the reasons why he buys like 9 out of 10 collections. Bobby Prager is the same way with Gary Posner and Incorporated. I have some other ones which I will not mention, that you will bring in a collection and it'll be worth $100,000 and you won't know what it is, and he'll offer you $500 and not think twice about it.
Well,
that's why you always have to go to more than one person.
I've heard stories where a dealer like Ray would buy a collection from a collector or an heir or something, and then discover something that he did not see when he looked at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And go back and actually give the seller more money because it was not fair.
Yeah.
He didn't see it. He got way more money, way more value than he expected. And he gives them...
Well, Ray has a little bit of a different thing because he's dealing with people at the upper end.
Well, of course.
Because he has more cash to spend. I mean, if you have a $500 collection, you know, who cares? But if you have, like in some cases, people will come to him with $50,000, $100,000 collections. And he was telling me about one. The person got three bids. One was $3,000, one was $4,000, and his was like almost $10,000. So he was 2.5 times higher. And at $10,000, he really looks at 100% markup. So he expects to sell that thing for $20,000.
Right.
The other people were really lowball. So what happens is he gives the guy $10,000, and the guy goes, hey, I've got more. And so then Ray ends up buying his entire collection, spends $250,000 with this guy. Because he dealt fairly with them in the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. It's always best to make your first offer your best offer.
Yeah.
And I've seen times when he's made an offer and the guy comes back and he wants more. And no, sorry, that's my offer.
Yeah.
That's all that's in it. And the guy either goes away. Sometimes he comes back and takes it, and sometimes he doesn't. But well, and sometimes years later, it's still for sale.
Yeah.
Because Ray's offer was the fairest offer.
Oh, you'll see these people go into stamp shows and there'll be 20 dealers like over at the Anaheim show. And they'll bring in a shopping bag with their grandfather's collection. And they'll go to this person and he really doesn't want it. So he offers $100. That's one of the reasons why you can't deal with fair too much. Because, you know, it's like a Russia collection and you go to the U.S. dealer and he goes, I'll give you $100 for it because I don't really deal with Russia. And then you go to another dealer, another dealer, another dealer, and he may get three bids, the low of 100 and the high of 500. It could have a huge range.
Yeah, but that has to do with the dealer, A, not knowing the material, and B, not being interested in the material.
Well, no, I don't think A even matters. It's B, it's not. No,
but that's,
they're not interested.
But that's what drives his offer.
Yeah.
And he's making an offer just to make an offer.
Yeah.
And fair, equitable, whatever you want to call it, you know, at that point, if it's not of interest to him, he should, you know, probably just say, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Instead of making that lowball offer, which kind of makes you look scummy.
Yeah. I agree with that. It's probably better, especially if you're in a stamp show and you know the person's going to walk around, to say, no, go to the next person instead of giving them a low offer. And hoping, like, maybe nobody else gives them another offer or something like that. I mean, you know, the dealers are going to try to make as much money as possible. But if they're pricing things at more than double, honestly, I mean, I work on a 25%. If I buy something for $100, I want to sell for $125. Because I know I'm going to give eBay 15 of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and your eBay model is just volume.
Yeah. Well, it's more than that. It's I fund my hobby, or I fund my habit. So, you know, I'll make $100, woohoo, and then I'll go off and buy more stamps.
Right.
At least it's healthy.
Ish.
Healthier than heroin, let's say.
And I think almost worse than something like that is somebody who does know what they have. And a perfect example of something like this is, you know, I used to watch Pawn Stars a lot.
I love Pawn Stars.
And someone would have some really cool thing, and they'd go, listen, I know nothing about this. I gotta talk to an expert. Cut scene, expert comes in. This is really cool. This is genuine. It's probably one of a kind, and it's probably in today's market worth about $50,000. Awesome. Okay, how much do you want for it? And the person turns around and goes, I want $50,000. No, because then what do I make out of it if I sell it?
Right.
You know, you've got to write it up. You've got to put it in your inventory. He's got to. It's amazing to me how many times you can watch that show and how many seasons that it's had. And in almost probably every other episode, someone's on there. An expert says it's worth $10,000. They want $10,000.
Yeah.
It's like, well, then go sell it yourself.
Yeah,
don't sell it to a pawn shop.
And the funny thing is they walked in, and when they walked in, they only wanted $1,000.
Yeah.
You see that too from time to time.
You see him in the parking lot going, oh, I hope this sells for $500, and it ends up being worth $10,000.
Right.
I went to San Diego for a stamp appraisal to purchase or whatever, and the people weren't stamp collectors. And they had a really cheesy little stamp collection, and then about $200 worth of postage. So at the time, postage was selling at 80%, so I offered them 75% of face. They thought I was a crook because inside of the stamp collection, they saw four U.S. number 64s, which catalog $800 each. And it's like they're not number 64s, they're 65s. At the time, I think they cataloged $2, $1, and I didn't want them. So, you know, they thought I was total crooks because here's $3,200 worth of stamps plus all the mint postage.
Let me guess, those 64s were faulty also.
Oh, yeah, stuff like that. So, you know, they didn't know what they had. They thought they had four stamps worth $3,200. And instead, of course, they were four stamps worth maybe, I would have, you know, if they would have said how much for these four stamps, I would have said $1.
Here's a number 64. It's worth $800, but it's torn in half, so I still want $400 for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you see that a lot, too. But, and you know, we have people come in here, and a person came in yesterday who thought he had the special printing of the 3-center. And I forget what it is, the number 65 special printing.
Now you're going to make me
think. Yeah, whatever.
Your brain, quick.
Whatever it was. But anyway, it's like a $7,000 stamp. And it's like, I had to tell them, you know, they made 1,700 special printings. They made 3.5 billion number 65s. Which one do you think you have?
It's not probable that he had it. But it's also not impossible.
Well, it's not impossible, but then he showed it to me, and it was used, and it was sort of a brownish color. It was the wrong color, the wrong perforations, the wrong cancel. You know, it was everything wrong. It's like, sorry, you know, keep looking, because people do find stuff. But, you know, and if I had gone and said, you know, I want to buy this collection, and I would have offered him $50, he would have said, oh, you're a crook. This stamp here alone is worth $7,000. It's like, no, it's not. So
knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. Which, by the way, that's one thing that we are not addressing right now. We are not addressing selling it yourself on eBay. If you really want to get the most money for your collection, sell it yourself.
But just remember, just like a dealer, you have to pay yourself to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's more than just paying yourself to do the work. You have to have the computer set up. You have to know how to mail the stuff. You have to be able to deal with all the feedback.
You have to pay for the electricity to turn on the computer.
Exactly.
You have to pay for the desk to sit at when you're running the computer.
So selling stuff on eBay is not free, but you will get a better price than if you sell it through a dealer.
Just wait until you get all the eBay and PayPal fees.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll realize quick how it's not free it is.
Well, it varies, but I am right around 15%. Well, if I sell a stamp for $100, $15 of it will go to PayPal and eBay, and the other $85 will go into my pocket. Now, if you go to an auction, you know, they're going to take probably 10%, maybe 15%, but let's say they take 10%. Well, they're not taking 10%. They're taking 10% from you. They're taking 15 to 18 from the buyer.
Or more sometimes.
Or more. So you're actually at 28%.
Right.
Because if a stamp is worth $100, people are smart. You know, they're smart rats. They're going to say, it's worth $100, but I'm going to have to pay $28 in commissions. I'm not going to bid it up to $100. I'm only going to bid it up to $72. So you are paying that full commission, whether you have to pay it or the buyer pays it.
And that's something that people have to understand. I mean, the hammer price isn't the price you end up paying.
Right. And it's also not the price reported.
Right.
You know, when you read Lynn's and it sold for $7,900, it actually sold for $7,100 plus the tip.
Right. And you don't get that $7,100. You only get $6,400.
Right. So yeah, again, because, you know, just like the dealer, the auction house has to pay for their rent, they have to pay for their lights, they have to pay for their printing, they have to pay for their advertising.
And their employees.
And their employees and everything. And, you know, you can fault a dealer for saying, I want to make 100%, and say, that's unfair. And the dealer is going to come back and say, for me to make $100, I have to sell this stamp. It has to actually sell. Which is that's a variable in itself. You know, do right. I ever sell this?
Yeah, and a dealer actually has to work at that sometimes. Right. They don't sell themselves.
Well,
they,
and again, you go back to that whole Pawn Stars thing. One of the things he said is, I have no idea how long this thing's going to sit in my store.
Yeah.
It's a one-off thing. Yeah, it's a great collectible, but I need the collector to come in to buy it.
Right. Yeah, which
if the buyer doesn't know you have it,
yeah,
you can't sell right. it.
Which is one more thing I wanted to address is... if you're selling revenue stamps, sell it to a dealer that deals in revenue stamps. If you're selling Russian stamps, sell it to a dealer who deals in Russian stamps. They're going to have buyers for this stuff. If you try to sell Russian stamps to a U.S. revenue stamp dealer, he's going to probably have to flip it off to another dealer.
That's if he even makes an offer.
If he makes an offer, yeah. And so you're going to, if you get an offer from that person, it's going to be a low offer.
Right.
Find out the people.
Because he knows he's going to have to sell it to the revenue dealer, and he's going to have to lose money.
Exactly.
Or not make much money, because the revenue dealer's got to make their money on it.
So you can't just go to any dealer and say how much for your collection. You need to go to several dealers, and preferably, you know, most people who are 84% of our listeners are U.S. listeners. So if you have a U.S. collection, take it to a dealer who has a U.S. base. Don't take it to a person who specializes in British Commonwealth.
And I think, I mean, when we're on the phone, you know, PSE-wise doing, and we get these calls all the time, the biggest recommendation we've always had is try and find a show in your local area.
Yeah.
Because then you're not even dealing with just one dealer. Usually you have, depending on the size of the show, anywhere from 5 to 10 to, you know, maybe 50 dealers at a big show, and you can shop it around all in one day.
Yeah, imagine going to New York with a stamp collection. How many dealers were there? 100 and...
200 and something?
Yeah, something like that. Just huge.
And then they had empty booths.
Yes, yes, there were empty booths.
So,
but I think they were also including societies and auction houses and things like that in their dealer count.
Oh, okay.
But there were also dealers like myself that were there that didn't have a booth.
People that walked the floor.
Right.
But still, yeah. I mean, don't just leave it at one dealer. Try and find a show.
Make as much money off your collection. You worked on it. You enjoyed it. You got your value out of it. But there's no reason for you to give away
and basically,
the equity you have in it.
Just remember, right. The longer you collect, your collection will build value over time. Because that stamp that you paid $10 for 50 years ago, or 40 or 30 or 20, will have likely gone up in value. The one you paid 25 cents for or 5 cents for, probably not so much.
Probably not at all.
But the stamps that you actually paid money for and mm-hmm. bought individually will likely have gone up in value over time. And so if you spent $2,000 putting your collection together and it's been 25 years, you might get a fairly large chunk of that back, if not all of it, depending on what you have.
Well, there was a, this is old though. It's from, I believe, the 1990s. And they did some research on that. And they said if you spent $1,000 on $10 stamps, in other words, your stamp collection had 100 stamps in it, you probably would be making about a $400 to $500 return if you bought stamps that were less than a dollar. So you have 1,000 stamps. Your $1,000, you will probably sell for about $200. Because, you know, like we always say, junk is junk.
Thank you for joining us for episode 80. This has been Cash, Scott, Tom, and I'm your host, Dawn. You can reach us with your questions or comments at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, or leave a message on our Google Voice number 1-949-873-4298. You can also check out our website at stampshowheretoday.com or follow us on Facebook or watch us on YouTube. And as always, keep collecting.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hi, this is Bob Prager with Gary Poser Incorporated. And we're in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey. And our philosophy at Gary Poser Incorporated is this. We would rather pay very fair prices on 9 out of 10 collections that we look at versus trying to just offer very low prices on 1 out of 2 and making a big score. That's never our philosophy. So if you want to be treated fairly, please give us a call anytime at 800-323-4279. And again, my name is Bob Prager.
Hi, this is Stephen Patillo, also known as Stamp Show Steve. I'm sitting here in the offices of PSE, Professional Stamp Experts, and I'd like to say hi and welcome you all to come to the various stamp shows once a month in Glendale, Van Nuys, and Anaheim. You can find all these dates, locations, and maps at stampshowsteve.com, and we welcome you to bring your stamps in to sell or buy or trade. There's multiple dealers there to help you fill in your collection or to buy what you may have for them. Return to sender. Return to sender.